want to begin by thanking Michelle and the others here for Michelle for organizing and the rest of you for actually staying till the end. So what I'm going to talk about today is some ongoing work on ultra-cold Fermi gases, and I'll sort of turn to a specific topic when we look at it and sort of really studying the superfluid insulator transition in optical lattices for these interacting Fermi gases. And I want to sort of acknowledge a number of people, particularly Ganesh Ramchandran, who's my graduate student, and Anton Burkov here at Waterloo, with whom a lot of this work has been done. So what are the topics that you're interested in? Broadly, it's sort of two categories. One is sort of looking at superfluidity and there are various aspects of this, such as studying the BCS-BC crossover, looking at superfluid insulator transitions, looking at instabilities of superflow and supersolid. Sort of a lot of the topics here, and things like ferromagnetism and so on, topics where there is a lot of overlap between condensed matter systems and these cold atomic gases. So really viewing the cold atomic gases as providing an example of strongly correlated phases of quantum fluids and trying to study properties of these kind of phases. Right? So an example, of course, a classic example is of strongly correlated superfluid would be something like liquid helium, for instance, where helium-4, where you have a normal liquid, a superfluid, but also the possibility that if you pressurize it, you can get crystalline phases and possibly even supersolids, although some this sort of ongoing research in what happens around this area when you start pressurizing the system. And one aspect of sort of the strong correlation is sort of manifest if one looks at the excitation spectrum, where in addition to the sound-like mode, one sees the Roton minimum, and which really reflects the fact that even though the system is not crystalline, there are very short distance strong correlations which give you a dip, sort of a peak in the structure factor and a correlated dip in the excitation spectrum. Another example, of course, again familiar to most of you, is systems like the high-temperature superconductors and other related materials, such as the heavy fermions that Piers was talking about this morning. And a lot of the interest in these kind of strong correlation aspects of cold atomic gases was really brought out by these experiments by Greiner and Bloch's group, Emmanuel Bloch's group, where they can actually take bosons and impose an optical lattice by counterpropagating laser beams in order to go from sort of the weakly correlated regime where these are really like gases which are very, very dilute and weakly interacting to a regime where they're strongly interacting, not because they are repelling each other more strongly, but because their kinetic energy is reduced a lot when you put them in a lattice. Right? So it's as if you increase the effective mass of these particles to a very large value, and hence the kinetic energy becomes now comparable to the strength of the interaction. So that was for a bosonic fluid. There's been subsequent work looking at Fermi superfluids, in particular the possibility that one can use what's called a Feshbach resonance, which is basically a resonance between sort of atomic states where you have spin up, spin down particles trying to scatter off of each other, and a molecular state which can be sort of brought into resonance with this by tuning an external magnetic, like a Zeeman magnetic field. And what happens as you tune the Zeeman magnetic field, which typically is like a few hundred Gauss in most of these systems like lithium and potassium that people work with, is that the scattering length basically diverges. And this divergence happens at the point where, if you just think of two particles, forget the fact that there's a molecule, the scattering length divergence corresponds to the fact that you're forming bound states of these two particles in three dimensions. So that's what the scattering length divergence is. On one side of this divergence is a BCS-like superfluid where you have, at low enough temperature, weakly bound Cooper pairs, which have a very large size, which is larger than the sort of interparticle spacing. Right? On the other side, the scattering length is positive. This just means that there is a molecular state below, so that if you scatter off two particles from vacuum, it'll appear that they repel each other. But really, this signals the existence of a tightly bound state formed by these atoms. So you can really think of this as a caricature of a molecule itself. Right? And these are sort of tightly bound Cooper pairs. If I forget about the fact that there are molecules present in the system, you can really think of this as a tightly bound Cooper pair with spin up and spin down bound into a singlet. And so, for example, a lot of the interest in this was sparked by sort of earlier work on what's called the BCS-BC crossover, namely this sort of work going back to Leggett asking, you know, if I start with a system of fermions and I have weak interaction, then I know that there is the BCS-like instability to forming superfluids like in conventional superconductors. On the other hand, we tend to think of helium-4, or tended to think of helium-4 as a distinct state where it was bosons that were actually Bose condensing. And really, this work by Leggett and Eagles and so on sort of brought to the sort of stressed upon the fact that in fact the smooth way to go between one limit, which is this BCS limit, to the BEC limit, simply by making these pairs smaller and smaller, you can actually go to the limit where you go from a conventional superconductor to what's something sort of more close to helium. Right? And a lot of the interest in sort of in these cold Fermi gases actually focused on trying to, I mean, gives you a sort of experimental way to probe aspects related to this crossover. So you can ask, for example, questions like, what governs the transition temperature of the superfluid as you start heating it up from zero temperature? And on the BEC side, you expect that, look, these are like bosons, and you heat them, and you're going to get some kind of a Bose condensation transition, which is governed by something like the density and the mass of the particles. Right? So you have some degeneracy temperature, and roughly the degeneracy temperature is the superfluid transition temperature. On the other side, the attraction is very, very weak. So these are really like BCS particles, right? BCS sort of Cooper pairs. And when you heat them, what you're not destroying is you're not sort of coherence is, I mean, you're sort of destroying coherence, of course, but the main thing is that you're actually breaking up these pairs as you heat the system on the BCS side of the of this crossover. But on the other hand, the ground state, even though there is a two-body sort of two-body problem, changes in a singular fashion. There's actually no bound state and a bound state. The many-body problem is actually smooth as you go through this crossover. Okay? And of course, there's been very nice work, and this is sort of from this particular one is from Ketterly's group, showing that there's direct evidence of superfluidity. If you look, for example, at rotating these superfluids, they're neutral superfluids. So the analog of imposing a magnetic field is to impose rotation. And if you impose rotation, you can see that the rotation sort of enters the system in the form of discrete vortices, which they can directly image. And again, they've looked at properties of these vortices as you tune through this BCS-BEC crossover. And again, it sort of forms this very nice abricot of vortex lattice that you can look at the images of. Another thing that people have done, and this sort of will lead into what I want to talk about further down, is that they've actually managed to load fermions into this optical lattice as well. So we're seeing this with bosons. They can also do the same thing with fermions. And this sort of goes back to some work a few years ago by Slinger's group, where they showed that you can actually tune the density of these fermions in this optical lattice, and you can observe basically the analog of, I mean, the Fermi surface, except it's in a trapped system, so you have to sort of keep account of the fact that there's an inhomogeneous trapping potential that they have, but modulo that factor, you have sort of a small Fermi surface where the fermions are sitting with small momentum centered around zero, and then as you keep filling them up, you begin to see sort of signatures of the lattice, and you can sort of make out that, okay, here you've filled, the first Brillouin zone has been filled for this optical lattice, has been filled with fermions. Right? So you can actually see, so this tells you that, okay, you can control density. You can actually go to low enough temperatures that you're seeing a degenerate Fermi system. And what people have done subsequently, this is sort of what I'll talk about in the rest of this talk, is that Ketterly's group has actually now tried to put the two together, namely this aspect of seeing band-like systems or band insulators, and the fact that you can actually get superfluidity in the presence of interaction. They sort of put them together, and in fact, they find that you can start with a superfluid, which is in the absence of a lattice, you start with a superfluid state. You now crank up a lattice at a density where there are two fermions per well or per site of this lattice, in a way that you go between a superfluid and a band insulator as you keep increasing this lattice depth. And that's going to happen at some sharp transition point, which they can locate experimentally. So they see an example of a superfluid to band insulator phase transition. And the way the signature sort of is seen here is they try to look for coherence by saying that, okay, let me imagine every Cooper pair collapses into a molecule and these get Bose condensed. Then I can look at what they call time of flight images, which is you release this gas from the trap and you're trying to look at signatures of coherence. So if you have molecules that are Bose condensed, you'll see a sharp peak at zero momentum for these molecules. And that's what they see here. right? So this thing here is in the absence of a lattice. You see a sharp dot here. This dark spot indicates a peak in the momentum distribution of molecules, which are basically, think of them as Cooper pairs now, right? So really bosons, which are both condensed. You turn on a lattice and you find that there are basically spots that appear on around k equal to 0, which just reflect the fact that there are now Bragg scattering processes that you that happen in the presence of a lattice. So in addition to k equal to 0, you'll get k equal to g, where g are sort of the reciprocal lattice vectors of the imposed lattice. And as you keep increasing it, of course, these additional spot intensities increase in the beginning, right? But eventually, all these spots disappear. And sort of forget this last image here, that's something else. But basically, it tells you that this coherence of these molecules is lost as you go to higher and higher lattice depths. Okay? So this signals for them the absence of superfluidity in, for example, at this particular value of the lattice depth. And what they're plotting now is the intensities of these various spots as a function of this lattice depth here, which they can tune. Right? So they find that initially this spot here, spot intensity increases, eventually it sort of collapses and goes to zero. So what we were trying to understand, this sort of motivated by some other theory work also, which I'll mention, but the model is sort of extremely straightforward in sort of contrast to solid state systems. Here, basically, everything is known about the problem. It's a fairly straightforward to state, which is that you have a particle with some kinetic energy moving in the lattice potential. And the lattice potential basically is simply this imposed laser field that's giving you some position-dependent sort of Stark effect. And what you get from what the interactions are is basically that you have effectively zero range interactions. So think of it like a delta function potential, which is leads to attraction between fermions. So these fermions have effectively zero range attractive interactions. Okay? They're very, very dilute. So the range of this attraction is very, very small compared to the typical things like what's the inverse Fermi wave vector or things like the lattice wavelength and so on, what's the lattice speed. So you can really replace this interaction by just a contact interaction. Okay. There's some danger of doing that, namely that you have to take into account the fact that if you just do bond scattering of this kind of a contact interaction, then of course the cross-section will just be proportional to g squared. But if you do repeated scattering with this contact potential, you can actually form bound states. So the scattering length is related to this factor GS here through this sort of relation coming from summing up these kind of diagrams of this sort. And in particular, what this tells you is that because of this particular sort of in three dimensions, it turns out there's a sort of ultraviolet divergence, which means that in order to treat the scattering problem, you have to scale this contact interaction in a way that you reproduce the sort of measured low energy scattering length. Okay, so those are just some sort of details, but sort of important for what I'll come to later. So this is sort of the the interaction part. The single particle part is fairly straightforward. You start with a k square by 2m dispersion, you crank up a lattice potential, and you open up a band gap in the system. Right? So this, for example, at a certain lattice depth is the lowest band. This is just the density of states as a function of energy for various lattice depths. So here, for example, at a small lattice depth, you see this one. The density of states does not have any gaps. You go to large enough lattice depth, you will open up a gap between the lowest band and the excited band. Okay, so that part is easy. Okay. So what are the things? So people have sort of tried and done like mean field studies of trying to look at the superfluid insulator transition. And you can plot, for example, phase diagrams. And I'll sort of come to what we do in a little. But just to mention, you can sort of get phase diagrams of the sort where you tune, for example, the chemical potential on one axis, and the other you tune the lattice depth. And let's say you fix your interaction to be such that it's at unitarity, for example. Right? Unitarity just means that the point where the scattering link diverges in the two-body problem. So what you get then are that there are superfluid regions. And in the superfluid, clearly, as you tune the chemical potential, the density is going to tune, density is going to change. You also find these insulating lobes where you tune the chemical potential, but the density is pinned to 2 fermions per bell. So you can sort of look at superfluid insulator transitions, and they've done this for three different interaction strengths. So one of them, for example, the middle one here is sitting at unitarity, but you can tune the interaction parameter, you get slightly different phase diagrams. and sort of very similar work, but I'll sort of come to this. So one thing is that there's sort of this. Okay, let me actually. So what do we have here? So what we want to set up now, and this is sort of the first step of trying to understand the system, is to try and see if one can come up with a sensible mean field description of the superfluid insulator transition. Right? So what do we have? We have a set of bands with some band energies. There is some interaction which, in a mean field theory, we can decompose into sort of a density field. So think of like a, you know, which in a superconductor or something is like the Hartree energy, which tells you that if you have a certain density and particles interacting with each other, it'll like effectively like a shift of the chemical potential if the density is uniform. The density is not uniform, there is some spatially varying potential, effective potential that these particles are going to see. There's also a pairing term, and the pairing and these potentials can of course be such that you can form Cooper pairs, and let's assume they are zero center of mass momentum, you can form Cooper pairs either between fermions in the same band, or they could be between fermions in different bands in general. Similarly, this Hartree potential, it's really like, more generally, you can think of this as a scattering problem where like, this potential can scatter fermions from band N to band N prime while preserving the K. So I'm assuming it's like maintains the translational invariance of the lattice. So one thing that sort of is important here is that in contrast to superconductors in solid state system, like solid state superconductors, in this system, this thing W sub S is actually just the G sub, it's just this contact interaction strength that we had there. But remember that that thing had to scale down as 1 over lambda, where lambda was this ultraviolet cutoff in the problem. Right? So that in fact, if you take that cutoff to infinity, this interaction term actually, this Hartree shift completely disappears for these systems. So another way to think about this is that, you know, imagine you have particles which have, you know, imagine think of the interaction range as like the size of the particle roughly, right? So if you have fat particles and they're attracting, they'll actually be able to take advantages of the attraction so that they'll see an effective potential that's modified. But here the particles have effectively zero range, so that even though they are sort of, they can form Cooper pairs, there is no Hartree shift in this problem at all, okay? So that's kind of unusual, and that's different from what one gets in solid state systems. In particular, this means that any attempt to model this by, you know, like a Hubbard type model is actually completely doomed, right? So you cannot model these attractive cold atom superfluids by any Hubbard type model where you necessarily have, you know, Hartree shifts and Cooper pairing, right? So that kind of program is completely gone. And the only reason I say this is that people have sort of, there's a lot of claims in the literature trying to say, oh, well, this kind of, we can write down one band Hubbard like models to try and describe these systems, and all of them basically are completely wrong. Okay. So, what do we have here? So one thing we've eliminated, okay, there's no Hartree shift in this problem. What about the pairing, right? And the pairing, it turns out you can sort of make two somewhat different approximations and they give different results. One is to say, let's do the most general thing. Let's keep pairing between any two fermions in sort of two different bands, so long as they have center of mass momentum, or crystal momentum being zero, I don't care which band they're from. So you can pair any two bands, you can sort of pair fermions. And the problem that this leads to is that if you look at the order parameter, it gives you a superfluid state where the order parameter is actually extremely strongly modulated. So it's very, very peaked at the center of the sort of lattice, each lattice well. But it's sort of very small in between two adjacent lattice wells. So what this means is that if you really want to treat this problem, you'd say, for example, one thing that's obvious is that if the order parameter becomes very small in between, there's clearly no Josephson coupling between them. Right? Another problem that is sort of more pertinent is that what this means is that, you know, you have, for example, I'm thinking of having a system where you have, let's say, two fermions per well. And if you have two fermions per well and your order parameter is very strongly varying on the scale of the lattice depth, this means that the order parameter is varying very, very strongly on the scale of the interparticle spacing, right? And again, this doesn't make any sense for an order parameter like this to be like a, defined as a classical object, right? So if you have very strongly varying order parameters on the scale of interparticle spacing, again, that mean field theory cannot be internally consistent. Okay? So it turns out that this interband mean field theory, although it's sort of the most general thing you can do, it turns out it gives incorrect results for this particular problem. So what we tried then was sort of a slightly simplified version which is to imagine that pairing only occurs between fermions in the same band but at opposite crystal momentum. So this is really like pairing time-reversed eigenstates, going back to Anderson's work on disordered superconductors. Sort of a very old work, except sort of in this context, it just means you pair fermions with opposite momenta in the same band. Okay. And this, of course, leads to sort of, you know, gap and number equations, as we know. Yeah. Right, so the interband pairing terms, you can sort of do a mean field theory of this problem, right? Except what we find is that the order parameter that results from this is extremely inhomogeneous. And I mean, one way to think about it is, you know, if you so let's sort of ask, what is this delta n prime k actually, right? It's the matrix element for it's like multiplying the order parameter, delta of r, by block functions that sort of are, it's multiplied by block functions of n, band n, and band n prime. And then you're summing over all possible reciprocal lattice vectors. So it turns out that if the order parameter is uniform, then this thing is zero. Okay. If the order parameter is non-uniform, then this thing is non-zero. So it turns out that if you allow for this to be non-zero, it wants to be extremely inhomogeneous, the order parameter. It wants to have more and more sort of interband pairing processes, and gives you. So what you get at the end of the day is, now imagine you have sort of two adjacent wells in this optical lattice, right? So just, let's just take a look at two adjacent wells. You find that the order parameter is extremely strongly peaked at the center of the well, but it goes to zero practically between the two wells. So if I want to compute something like Josephson coupling, which would rely on having a sizable order parameter in the region where these two talk to each other, right, then you conclude that that Josephson coupling will be zero. Right, so No, it's not fine. No. So this is translationally invariant from one well to the next. It's just that within each well, the wave function is strongly, not the wave function, but this order parameter is strongly modulated within each well. But it's translationally invariant. So if you translate by one lattice period, of course, it's translationally invariant. We are only looking at translationally invariant states here. No. At this, I mean, at weak enough lattice depth, you do. At weak enough lattice depth, that is the case, right? Because the lattice potential is weak, you clearly have no gap in the density of states, and you can't even identify bands as independent. Right? If you go to strong enough lattice depths, then you open up a gap. So I'll sort of mention what the phase diagram is in just a moment. But yeah. So if you do allow for interband pairing, the order parameter becomes too strongly modulated. So if you want to get a consistent description using this interband mean field theory, then you have to, interband picture, then you have to go beyond mean field theory. Okay? So either you keep interband pairing and you keep strong fluctuations, or, and this seems to us to sort of work reasonably well, is that you completely ignore pairing between different bands. Okay? And if you ignore pairing between different bands, then of course the problem sort of simplifies. It just looks like basically you have instead of one gap, it's like one gap equation, but really instead of sort of one band here that would have appeared if you had a single band problem, you have many bands and you get sort of this gap equation. Okay? Except the gap is not really, this really is the sort of, you should really think of this as the order parameter modulation components of the order parameter. The gap is, of course, some single global gap that we'll sort of define later, but this is a spatially varying order parameter field. And this is the average density, of course. This number equation is sort of very similar to what you get from BCS theory. Yeah. 5 minutes? Yeah, I'll be done. So what we have now is that, and this is sort of the second surprising aspect of this, is that if one looks at this gap equation, in the limit, again, that this coupling constant scales like 1 over the cutoff, right? So remember, this was just this contact potential, which I had to scale as 1 over cutoff to reproduce the scattering length correctly. In that case, you're forced to actually conclude that this sum here right? If you want a non-zero value for delta, you want that this sum here should diverge as lambda, as the cutoff, right? So this thing goes like 1 over cutoff. If this thing went like the cutoff, you would get a non-zero result at the end of the day. It turns out that this thing scales as the cutoff only for g equal to 0, okay? Which means only the uniform order parameter survives in the limit that the cutoff is taken to infinity, which it should be, I mean, eventually, because there's just some contact. I mean, it's like the cutoff, really the cutoff is like the inverse range of the interaction, right? But that's small enough that you can basically take it to infinity. So it just tells you that only the g equal to 0, or this uniform component of the order parameter survives, even though there is a lattice present in the problem. And basically this tells you that, you know, unlike in solid state systems where pairing is dominated by things happening near the Fermi level, like within a Debye energy of the Fermi level, here what's dominating the system, what's dominating the ground state is actually physics way higher in energy, actually, right? So these particles are Cooper pairs, like in, if you take an S-wave Cooper pair, and you ask, well, what's the wave function of this Cooper pair? It turns out to be divergent at short distances, right? And it's this short distance sort of 1 over r sort of increase of this Cooper pair wave function that dominates all the physics in these systems. Okay. So you can then compute, for example, things like what's the condensate fraction, for example, that they measure in experiment, right? They measure in experiment, they transform Cooper pairs into molecules, say, well, what's the condensed fraction of these molecules? And you can sort of ask, well, is this condensate fraction uniform? And it turns out that it does, is not. Okay. This condensate fraction can, in fact, be non-uniform. And you can sort of see that, OK, there's a uniform component to it. There are modulated, various modulated components at sort of various reciprocal lattice vectors. And you can sort of reproduce qualitatively various aspects, and even sort of semi-quantitatively things like the critical lattice depth and so on can be reproduced using this. Okay. So this sort of comes back to the question that John is asking, namely, if you have, I mean, there's an excit, okay, so this part of it is different. So there's just an excitation gap here showing that if you want to make excitations in the system, then of course, at small lattice depths, what it tells you that the system is gapped is the fact that you form pairs. At large lattice depth, the gap is finite simply because you've made a band insulator, okay? But the essence of this thing is that, you know, imagine I turn on the lattice depth here. There is a certain critical lattice depth in the non-interacting problem at which the system goes from being a metal to being an insulator, okay? So clearly this, with two fermions per well, this is going to happen when basically this lowest band splits off in energy, so there's a gap in the density of states. On the other hand, if I ask, well, where does the superfluid insulator transition happen? The superfluid insulator transition happens at a lattice depth which is larger than this, right? So in this intermediate window here, it's what you've done is effectively converted a band insulator into a superfluid simply because the interactions are very, very strong, right? So it's like taking silicon and turning on a traction and converting it into a superconductor. So it's roughly, that's the analog, but in these kind of systems. Okay. And of course you expect that, you know, imagine you take the superfluid and you ask, well, what about properties of things like vortices in the system? You expect that if you're here, a vortex will have a core that will basically look normal, right? So there'll be like a lot of normal fluid in the core, you expect vortices to have strong dissipation. If you move here, you expect that the vortex core will reflect something about the like the underlying normal state, right? And the underlying normal state here is an insulator, it's a band insulator. So you might expect that these vortices will be strong, will have strong dissipation here. They may be much more mobile and have very little dissipation if you're in this region here. So maybe there is some kind of things like vortex liquids and so on. There might be some hope that it might emerge here. In sort of this, in this window. Okay. So finally, just a quick this thing that we've also looked at aspects like the breakdown of superfluidity, which people have explored in the case of bosons. And so it turns out that in this sort of, all this work is actually done my student Ganesh, is that you can actually ask, well, what's the spectrum of collective excitations look like in a superfluid? And it seems, for example, you know, if I look at as a function of momentum, if you plot, for example, and this is in the case where specifically looking at strongly correlated superfluids is an example, taking a one-band problem as a simpler example to begin with, it turns out that you can get, for example, dips in the excitation spectrum very reminiscent of rotons and liquid helium, right? And again, in this model, it simply arises because of the fact of that these interactions give you strong short-distance charge correlations. you can impose a superflow and ask, well, how does superfluidity break down? And it turns out there are in these lattice systems, you can get dynamical instabilities where, for example, because of the fact that there are charge density waves in these kind of systems, which can be very close in energy to a superfluid, once you drive the superfluid with enough superflow, you can actually say that, well, the kinetic energy is too high. I want to actually convert the system into some kind of a density wave. So you can actually get various instabilities, including dynamical instabilities, which are reflective of the fact that there is a competition between superfluid ground states and charge density wave ground states in these kind of systems. And hopefully one can try and explore physics of the sort in a more complicated context like these cold atom systems. Okay, so just to summarize, we sort of looked at interacting superfluids with cold gases. We found that because of the fact that these are really zero range attractive interactions, you get very different physics from what is seen in solid-state superconductors, namely things like Hartree shifts don't exist. Things like the pairing field are actually dominated not by a thin shell in energy around the Fermi surface, but by stuff that's going on very, very high in energy. So even though there are sort of, you know, condensed matter type problems that one would like to think about in these gases, I guess one has to keep in mind that they can be very, very different in some ways. So thank you for your attention. So the idea is actually very simple. So imagine you have, you know, the way you can model these the interatomic potential of these gases, right, is you can really think of them as having a small range where there is an attractive interaction, right? I'm replacing it by delta function, but in reality, it's really some short range over which it's attractive, and then it's pretty much zero, right? So the actual Hartree shift that you get is only going to happen when two fermions actually come and feel this potential, right? So the effect of Hartree shift actually scales like the density times the cube of the range of the interaction. Right? And that is much, much smaller than other energy scales in the problem. It's approximate, but it's good. I mean, it's a good approximation in the sense that the range typically is three orders of magnitude smaller than all other length scales in the problem, like the Fermi wave vector, inverse Fermi wave vector. Right. So, no, we are treating it as zero, but the first correction we are saying is extremely small. For what? In which problem, though? In the continuum, or? Yes, there is. Yeah. So you are just asking in the continuum without this lattice potential. With lattice potential, so it depends. If the starting state is metallic, so there's finite density of states at the Fermi level, then for an arbitrary weak contact interaction, you can get a BCA superfluid. If you have a band gap that opens, then the particular phase diagram that I was showing you where there's a region that's actually a band insulator that gets converted into a superfluid only happens if you're close to unitarity. So if you have strong interactions, that is true. If you have weak interactions, then everything that's a metal becomes a superfluid. Everything that's an insulator stays an insulator. Do all bands have the same Fermi surface? Okay, so there's a problem, which is, there's basically two problems. One is that if you have a weak lattice potential, right? So that's provided there is pairing between different bands, right? Now, pairing between different bands is only active if you have strong modulation in the order parameter. Right? So for weak lattice depths, it's not going to happen. Right? For strong lattice depths, we have reasons to believe that this interband pairing might not be a good approximation. Maybe it's true if you have like a large number of particles, then maybe that's something to worry about. But for small enough particle numbers, this interband mean field theory doesn't sort of seems qualitatively incorrect. So even though that might be true in principle, it seems that you would have to really worry about fluctuation effects. Okay,